every year, because
right.
if I'm thinking that, and there's 4,100 other people in my collective that are also thinking that, then there's a lot of claims and a lot of increase. It's just getting passed back to us.
Right. Get the right thing for that service, not just something.
Right, yeah.
Not just everything.
I'm telling you, I know what it would be, too. Like, if we had chiropractic on our plan, I would use that probably every month or two.
That'd actually benefit you. Alternative care does tend to keep your costs lower as well.
Right. I mean, that's essentially preventative care in another way anyways.
It is, and it's just delivered really cost effective.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's just about all the time that we have for tonight. Up next is going to be Prison Pipeline. But thanks, everyone. This has been Labor Radio. It's been an exciting half an hour, and we'll see you next time.
Have a great night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a benefit concert for Standing Rock Legal Defense taking place Wednesday, March 22nd at O'Connor's Vault in Portland.
This evening of folk and protest music features the Road Sodas, Gary Furlow and the Loafers, and Woodlander.
This is a 21 and over event.
Again, that's a benefit concert for Standing Rock Legal Defense taking place Wednesday, March 22nd at O'Connor's Vault, 7850 Southwest Capitol Highway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. My guest is Julia Yashimoto, an attorney with Oregon Justice Resource Center. She is a project director for the center's Reentry Law Project and the Woman in Prison Project. Julia is dedicated to using her law degree to increase access to justice, and she does this by providing quality legal assistance through partnerships with Mercy Corps Northwest and with Red Lodge Transition Services, a Native American organization. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you for having me.
Julia recently released a report called Unlocking Measure 57 that includes a timeline of the changes to Oregon sentencing laws over the past few decades. And as Oregon legislators are faced with a decision to open a second woman's prison, Julia's report says we must instead repeal Measure 57. So, Julia, among Oregon's mandatory minimum sentencing laws, Oregonians are more familiar with Measure 11, but Measure 57, I believe, is less understood. So let's start with, what is Ballot Measure 57, and what was your goal in writing this report, Unlocking Measure 57?
So Ballot Measure 57 is a ballot measure that was passed in 2008 that increased presumptive sentences for the repeat property offender statute, as well as creating higher presumptive sentences for certain drug crimes. And our hope with releasing this report, Unlocking Measure 57, was to better explain to the community what Measure 57 is about and how the repeat property offender statute, which we feel is having a huge impact on justice-involved women, how it actually operates and what it does. Every year, we have a Women in Prison conference that we use to focus on issues of justice-involved women and provide community education. And this most recent Women in Prison Conference last year in October 2016, we focused on sentencing. And we walked through different aspects of sentencing and how it impacts women. And one of our presenters, Eric Dietrich, talked about Measure 57 and specifically the repeat property offender statute and walked us through the history of Oregon's sentencing laws that leads to the repeat property offender statute under ballot Measure 57 being even more punitive than I think voters anticipated when they voted on it. And the way that he broke it down, when we saw this presentation, we thought we really need to get this into a form that people can refer to so that they can better understand what's happening.
And your report says that Measure 57 accounts for nearly half the women serving time at Oregon's Coffee Creek Correctional Facility.
Measure 57 has made big changes to the repeat property offender statute. And in 2016, it was close to half of the women incarcerated in Coffee Creek were in for property crimes.
Julia, you have a timeline in your report that talks about how the laws pre-1989 were tweaked, amended, and changed over the years until Oregonians finally voted in ballot measure 57 in 2008. So pre-1989, you say that that was a time when judges could decide whether a felon was put on probation or sent to prison, and the parole boards decided release dates.
Well, pre-1989, Oregon had an indeterminate sentencing structure, which meant that the courts would order both a minimum and a maximum prison term for defendants, and then the parole board would had a role in deciding what the release dates were. And that was the indeterminate sentencing structure was changed in 1989, which was similar to what was happening throughout the rest of the country, that other states, including Oregon, went to what was considered a determinate sentencing structure. And Oregon adopted a sentencing guideline structure where courts were then ordering not a minimum and a maximum time, but rather a specific sentence, that the parole board no longer has a role for the most part in determining when a person is released.
And this was a 99-block grid. Talk about this sentencing guidelines grid that we used beginning in 1989.
So we still use the sentencing guideline grid. And when a defendant is sentenced, what's taken into account is their criminal history score and crime seriousness. So the sentencing guidelines are a grid, and down one side of the grid, your crime seriousness is scored, and across the top of the grid, you're given a criminal history score. And so where your criminal history score and your crime serious score meets on this grid, that is your sentence for your conviction. And then judges are able to downward depart or upward depart from that sentence based on substantial and compelling reasons. So an upward departure would be an increased sentence from where you land on the grid, and a downward departure would be a lower.
So do judges still have that discretion when they sentence using this guideline grid?
So judges are still able to depart from the guidelines, except in cases where they're restricted from doing so by statute.
So Julia, the term presumptive sentences is important throughout the following decades. So explain, what does that mean?
So presumptive sentences are the sentences that must be imposed on the defendant based off of where they land on this grid, unless there are substantial and compelling reasons to depart from that sentence.
Julia, also in 1989, there were amendments by the Oregon legislature that allowed separate criminal episodes to be joined in the same indictment. Explain that. How did that work?
So in 1989, the legislature expanded the joinder rule. So the expansion of the joinder rule by the legislature allowed prosecution to include in a single indictment crimes that occurred out of separate criminal episodes, as long as there were some similarities with those charges. So if you had committed crimes over a longer time period, instead of having having to bring one case for each of those criminal episodes, prosecutors under the joinder rule as it is now can sort of bring all of those charges over all of those criminal episodes into one indictment, into one case. Also in 1989, the legislature amended the criminal history rule. And this change in the criminal history rule will be a big part or a significant piece of why later when ballot measure 57 was passed, it casts a wider net for defendants than some people might realize. So what the criminal history rule is it determines what prior convictions can be used in your sentencing when you're talking about what your criminal history score is going to be or what is factored into your sentencing. So before the change in 1989, it was at sentencing, what was taken into account are the crimes or the convictions that you had before the crime was committed. After 1989, it became what convictions you had before you were being sentenced. So it changes the reference point of when your criminal convictions are being counted.
And you have an example of the State versus Buchholz in 1993.
In 1993, the Oregon Supreme Court decided State v. Buchholz. In State v. Buchholz, the defendant committed the crime of theft in the first degree and then about a month later committed the crime of unlawful delivery of methamphetamine. So in these two very separate criminal episodes, the defendant was sentenced in the same hearing. And the judge used the initial theft conviction to up his criminal history score for the unlawful delivery of methamphetamine. In State v. Buchholz, what they looked at was whether or not a judge could use a conviction of a prior criminal history or criminal episode conviction in the same sentencing hearing to up a later conviction. And what the Supreme Court said was that a judge could use a prior conviction from different criminal episodes, even when sentenced in the same proceeding, to increase the criminal history score for the defendant. But the Supreme Court also used permissive language, saying that the judge was permitted to do this, and this gave the sentencing court discretion to determine not to do this, to not to use a prior conviction in the same sentencing hearing to up a criminal history score.
And then, not in your report, but I do want to mention that in 1994, Oregon voters passed ballot measure 11. Now, this is another mandatory minimum sentencing law that is for certain felony crimes. And it's our one strike, you're out law, where 15-year-olds could be tried as adults. And the least amount of prison time under Measure 11 is 5 years, 10 months. Prisoners must serve the entire sentence. And these mandatory minimum sentencing laws override these sentencing guidelines, correct?
Correct.
So we have our first ballot measure on the books here in Oregon. And then 1996 through 2001, lots of legislative additions, changes, clarifications, starting with the repeat property offender statute. So talk about that.
So in 1996, the Oregon legislature created the repeat property offender statute. And this was at a time when Oregon was facing very high rates of property offenses. And what the repeat property offender statute did is it created a presumptive sentence, so outside of the sentencing grid, it created a presumptive sentences for individuals that had prior convictions for property crimes.
Thus the repeat property offender statute. And again, this statute was then changed several times, starting in 1999.
So in 1999, the Oregon legislature added the crime of identity theft and also added identity theft into the repeat property offender statute. So it became one of the crimes that could be considered for this presumptive sentence.
Your report says that in 1999, the Oregon legislature created the crime of identity theft. And you say it is an expansive and vague law. Explain.
So the identity theft statute has been criticized for its vagueness. For example, it's a Class C felony, but there's no sort of dollar amount or harm that needs to have taken place in order to be convicted of identity theft. So in cases of theft, you know, oftentimes when you think about theft, the amount of property or the value of the loss is taken into account to determine what degree of theft it is and whether it's going to be a misdemeanor or what level of felony. With identity theft, it doesn't take into account any sort of dollar amount. So if you are charged and convicted of identity theft, you're facing a Class C felony.
So give an example of a crime that that would affect.
If, for example, you use someone else's credit card and charge $10 for it, that could be charged as identity theft, and you're facing a Class C felony, even though the loss is an amount of $10. Whereas if you were stealing $10, you wouldn't be facing a charge that's a felony charge. You'd probably be facing something that's a misdemeanor.
Does this affect a lot of the women?
A lot of the women who are in Coffee Creek have identity theft convictions.
So we can see that the legislative additions and changes and tweaks, how it's increased the number of people who face higher presumptive sentences or longer prison terms.
Yeah, the changes in the laws over time have increased the number of individuals that can fall under the repeat property offender statute. And so this can even include individuals who are not who you think are repeat property offenders. I've met individuals who, for the first time, have been charged and convicted on property crimes, but they sort of had, in the worst moments of their life, have committed property offenses over maybe the period of several weeks. And they, for the first time, are before a sentencing judge on property crimes, but are sentenced as repeat property offenders.
So these are people who are facing a personal crisis in their life at that time that they commit this crime, and they're caught in this net of mandatory minimum sentencing laws.
Yes, and because of the way that prosecutors have discretion to charge offenses, they can charge the offenses so that you can be caught up in the repeat property offender statute and really stack up what your presumptive sentence looks like.
So now we're at 2008 with ballot measure 57 is on the ballot, along with ballot measure 61. So explain how ballot measure 57 came about here in Oregon.
So ballot measure 57 was proposed at a time when, in response to ballot measure 61. And ballot measure 61 proposed very punitive sentences and very harsh sentences for drug and property crimes.
And they were both on the ballot at the same time. Ballot measure 61 was state Republican Kevin Mannix's proposal, along with out-of-state funding.
And advocates against ballot measure 61 saw proposing ballot measure 57 as the only way to really defeat ballot measure 61. So ballot measure 57 also increased presumptive sentences and was projected to increase costs to the state for increased prison beds, but not to the extent that ballot measure 61 was projected to do.
And also ballot measure 57 had a promise of funding for drug court and drug treatment, which ballot measure 61 did not, correct?
Correct.
So this was 2008 when Oregonians passed ballot measure 57, Julia. And this was during a time, 2005 and 2010, when Oregon was experiencing the largest property crime rate drop of any state.
That's correct. That's what the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission had stated about that time period. From 2005 to 2010, Oregon was facing a real drop in property offenses.
So we'll never know if we would have this property and drug mandatory minimum sentencing law here in Oregon had not it been proposed in opposition to Kevin Mannix's ballot measure 61.
So that's my understanding as well. So ballot measure 57 did a few things to drug and property offense statutes in Oregon. It created new mandatory and higher penalties for drug crimes that were involving large amounts of controlled substances. It also prohibited the court from imposing probation on a person's second delivery or manufacturing of controlled substances offense. But what we focus in the report is what it did to the repeat property offender statute, because our focus is on the women's prison population and justice-involved women, and women are in large part being convicted of property offenses. So with the repeat property offender statute, what it did was it increased the presumptive sentences, both sort of a base presumptive sentence that someone faced, as well as it allowed for the addition of 2 months to your presumptive sentence for prior property convictions. And so it really bumped up the presumptive sentence that individuals were facing. It also took away judicial discretion to depart from those presumptive sentences for substantial and compelling reasons, and instead allowed departures only for very limited circumstances.
What is the sentencing? How many years?
It varies depending on how you're charged and convicted. So,
what is the minimum sentencing under ballot measure 57?
With the changes that ballot measure 57 made to the repeat property offender statute, I believe that the lowest presumptive sentence an individual can face is 18 months, unless they fall within those strict guidelines of when a judge can downward depart from that sentence. So ballot measure 57 was projected to increase prison beds and the cost to the state. And in 2009, when Oregon was facing an economic recession, the legislature, with House Bill 3508, suspended the changes made to the repeat property offender statute from February 15, 2010 to January 1, 2012. And when you look at the prison intake numbers, you'll see a drop in prison intakes during that time of suspension, and then a spike in women's prison intakes after the changes to the repeat property offender statute come back into effect.
So they had to suspend putting ballot measure 57 into effect. And what was that spike? Was that a significant spike in women's incarceration once that did go back into effect?
It was a significant spike in the number of beds that women were filling at the prison.
If you just tuned in, this is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. My guest is Julia Yashimoto, an attorney with the Oregon Justice Resource Center, and we are talking about her new report, Unlocking Measure 57. So, Julia, ballot measure 57 was passed by Oregon voters in 2008. It was suspended for about 2 years. Then in 2013, we have the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, huge sentencing reform package here in Oregon. It was House Bill 3194. So how did that impact Measure 57 or Oregon's sentencing laws?
So with House Bill 3194, there was just a small change to the presumptive sentence for the repeat property offender statute. And so if you fell into the repeat property offender statute because of a robbery in the third degree or an identity theft, your starting presumptive sentence was dropped from 24 months down to 18 months. But what we've seen since that change is that that change didn't have really any sort of effect on prison intakes for women or length of stay for women.
As you said, ballot measure 57 was suspended for at least 2 years due to it just cost too much. So the Oregon legislature is currently in session and Oregon is facing a budget deficit. Do you think that this will affect the decision on whether to open a second women's prison?
I think that the state of Oregon should really take this opportunity to look at real long-lasting reform. We're in a budget deficit. The cost of opening up a second women's prison for the first biennium is close to $20 million. The Criminal Justice Commission is estimating that if ballot measure 57 is no longer in effect, that 70 prison beds for women would be saved by July 2019 and 130 beds by July 2021. Right now, the women's prison is overcrowded. Coffee Creek Correctional Facility is built for 1,253 women. I think the most recent count as of March 1st was 1,284 women. And so if these projections are correct and ballot measure 57 is no longer in effect, these 70 prison beds that are saved by 2019 would allow for Coffee Creek Correctional Facility to run without having to open up a second women's prison.
So you just laid out how all these changes and tweaks and additions to the sentencing laws over these past decades have widened the net, tripling the Oregon woman prison population over the past at least 20 years.
Yes, over the last 20 years, the rate of incarceration for women in Oregon has tripled. And what we have seen is that a large driver of that is the way women are being sentenced for property crimes.
And Julia, talk about some of the alternatives to incarcerating women and some of the problems with when we talk about mothers and foster care, you know, the collateral consequences that go along with sending women to prison.
What I see and when I talk to women who are convicted in Coffee Creek for property offenses is that most often these offenses are driven by drug addiction. And it is something that, if you think about drug addiction, this is a repeated behavior despite negative consequences. And it's really a public health issue. And what we are doing by penalizing property offenses in this way, driven by drug addiction, is that we're using the prison system to try to address these social and public health problems like drug addiction.
And your report says that ballot measure 57 does little to address these root causes of property crime.
What I see for the women who are incarcerated in Coffee Creek is that they recognize that drug addiction is what's driving their offenses. But in the prison system, drug treatment is very limited. And in fact, if you are eligible or able to get into the intensive drug treatment program, you're doing that at the end of your sentence. So the women who are facing long sentences, like 8-10 years for these property offenses, are in prison for years, trying to do as much programming as they can, getting involved in whatever they can, knowing, though, that what they really need is drug treatment and what they really need is counseling. A lot of these women have histories of trauma, been victims of violence. So they're spending many years in prison without access to what it is that they really need and what they're really hoping to get until the end of their sentence. And so some of the women ask me, you know, what is it that I do for these, you know, 4 or 5 years before I'm even eligible for drug treatment. And because of the limited number of beds in the drug treatment program, not everyone who needs it or wants it is able to get drug treatment while they're in prison. The other thing that I've seen with the women who are incarcerated in Coffee Creek is that most of them are mothers, and a lot of them were primary caregivers before they were incarcerated. And so this has a huge impact on their relationship with their children when they're incarcerated for many years for these nonviolent offenses. And even when women are incarcerated for a shorter sentence, like 18 months, this disruption in their relationship with their children can be incredibly detrimental, and women are at higher risk of losing their children, losing parental rights of their children. And if we're thinking about helping people to rehabilitate and to deter future criminal activity, women's connection with their children has a big impact on how they see reentry and how they see their ability to successfully be back in the community. And so when we're breaking those relationships, we're really setting the women up to have a very difficult time of being successful when they're coming out.
And there are statistics that show that children of incarcerated parents have a very difficult time themselves.
Yes. And the women themselves recognize that. I've talked to women who know about those studies, and they try to do the best that they can to stay in communication and connection with their children. But for a number of reasons, the distance that maybe their children live from Coffee Creek, or the cost of phone calls, or the challenges with the video chats, make it really difficult for them to even though they know that their children are now at higher risk and are doing everything they can to maintain that relationship, it's very difficult from prison.
How can people obtain your report, Unlocking Measure 57?
They can go to our website at www.ojrc.org.
And how can people help encourage our Oregon legislators to repeal Measure 57?
They can contact their legislators and let them know that this is an issue that they care about, that they are not in support of these very punitive sentences that don't make sense for public safety and the welfare of our communities. And I think that this document helps to break down Measure 57 because it is a complicated ballot measure, and the repeat property offender statute itself is complicated, and how the repeat property offender statute is implemented because of ballot Measure 57 is complicated, and I think that this report helps to break that down for people.
And Julia, you did a beautiful job breaking
Thank
that
you.
Down. Thank you so much for being my guest. Can people call you if they have questions? Or if legislators have questions?
People are free to contact us, and our telephone number is 503-944-2270.
You have been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. My guest again has been Julia Yashimoto with Oregon Justice Resource Center. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineers, Danielle and Mike. Good night.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the closing celebration for Giving Back, the Soul of Philanthropy, on Thursday, March 23rd at 6 p.m. at Concordia University's Library in Portland. This event celebrates months of learning, sharing, and growing through the Giving Back, the Soul of Philanthropy exhibit. The celebration will feature performances by Taja Williams and the Barramacona Drummers. Again, that's the closing celebration for Giving Back, the Soul of Philanthropy, March 23rd, at 6 o'clock at the Concordia University's Library and Learning Center at 2800 Northeast Liberty Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community.
Please join us on Saturday, March 25th for an Archives Database Edit-a-thon and party. This event will run from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. We are recruiting current and past KBOO volunteers and listeners who hold knowledge of KBOO's 49-year history, and we are recruiting archivists like